Well, good morning. My name is Ben. I'm the lead pastor here at CORE. And like Josh said earlier, we are so incredibly excited. We count ourselves privileged that each and every one of you are here with us as we arrive at the finish line with part three of this series that we've been in over the course of the last month that we've been calling The Weight of Your Words. And throughout this series, we've been acknowledging this reality that in every single one of our lives, in every relationship that we have, and in every conversation that we enter into, our words matter. That the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, couldn't be further from the truth. Because as we've experienced on the receiving end, and if we got honest enough and look close enough, what we've dealt out as we've spoken words to other people is that every word we speak has the potential to bring light and life into our relationships. But in the inverse, every word we speak also has the ability to inflict scars and wounds. And that reality should concern every single one of us. But if you walked into this room and you consider yourself to be a Jesus follower, that reality should concern us even more. Because if you're a Jesus follower, getting this right isn't optional. This is a responsibility for those of us who call ourselves Jesus followers to get our words right as we communicate and do relationship with other people. And here's why. Because if we get this right, we make the people around us better. But if we get this wrong, we lose the right to be heard. If we get this right, we simply become an annoyance to the people around us. And this compelling message of hope, the most compelling message of hope of all time that we have been given, the gift that we've received as Jesus followers and are now commissioned to communicate to the world around us, goes out the window with it. You see, for every single one of us, this matters within our relationships. It matters that we get it right because we have the potential to either make people better or make people worse every single day with the words that we speak. And throughout this series, we've been coming back each week to this one central passage. It's this passage that we believe with all of our heart doesn't rob us of fun. It's not meant to control us. It's a passage that gives us some insight into how we become people who are capable of making the greatest impact possible. Dare I say, the maximum impact with our words every single day. It's a passage that begins to outline what our conversation should look like and how we should watch our words because of the power and the weight of our words in every conversation with our spouse, in every conversation with our kids, in every conversation with our coworkers, and yes, even in every conversation we have with the waitress at the restaurant. You see, here's this passage that we've been coming back to week after week. It's a passage that Paul writes in his letter to the church in Ephesus. And here is what Paul writes as his instruction to us and how we get this right to make the people around us better. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29, it says this. And it's a perfect opportunity, if you haven't done so already, to crack open that weekly that you got when you walked in. On the inside, you'll find a notes page that we've designed specifically for you to help you follow along with us as we move through the text. Maybe even grab a pen from the seat back in front of you and fill in some blanks of some things that you can hang on to as you walk back out into your real world tomorrow morning, or everything will come up on the screen for you as well. But here's what Paul writes. Don't use foul or abusive language. Let everything you say be good and helpful, so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear them. And throughout this series, we've come back to this one key word that eliminates the wiggle room within this passage. Let everything you say be good and helpful so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear them. Every word that comes out of your mouth should make the people around you better. You see, that, my friends, carries significant weight. That accentuates the importance of the words that we speak every single day. But there's good news in this. And the good news is this, is that you get to decide whether your words bring light and life or whether your words bring scars and wounds to the people around you. You get to decide whether your words make the people around you better or the people around you worse. You are the primary deciding factor in every word that you speak. We get to choose whether we get to work on this and make the adjustments necessary so that our conversations and our relationships go to a healthier level. We get to choose to remind ourselves that the relationships we have with others are rarely the same relationships they have with us. That within our relationship, it's the same relationship but two different vantage points. The same relationship, but two different sets of power, authority, and influence. The same relationship, but two different sets of wants and needs in every relationship that we're in. And by reminding ourselves of that truth, it begins to adjust the way we approach that relationship and the conversations within that relationship. We get a choice of whether or not we remember who we are and what we represent to the person on the other side of the conversation. Remember who we represent in every conversation that we have. That within our conversations, people have the potential to see a glimpse of Jesus through me. That if you consider yourself to be a Christ follower, that in every conversation you have and every word that you speak, people have an opportunity to see Jesus through you. And are you painting an accurate picture of who Jesus is? Or not? Am I painting an accurate picture of who Jesus is or not? But what we said throughout this series is this, is that in order for us to get better at getting this right, it requires us to begin to better understand our relationships and better understand some dynamics of the words that we speak. And so throughout this series, we've been uncovering three different dynamics of our words, that when we understand these three different dynamics just a little bit better and we remind ourselves of these dynamics in every relationship of our lives and every conversation that we enter into, it begins to change the way that we speak. A couple weeks ago, Josh did an incredible job at kicking off this series by highlighting this first dynamic, and it's this, that our words are not equally weighted. That in all lives, with the words that we speak, negative words weigh way more than positive words. Psychologists would back up this fact. That within all lives, with our conversations, it takes 5 positive affirmations to counterbalance 1 negative conversation or 1 negative word spoken into somebody else. Our negative words carry weight. Not all words are equally weighted in our lives. And then last week we continued this series with this second dynamic, that source determines weight. That the source of the words that are being spoken ultimately determine how much weight those words carry. And as we apply that to our lives, what it means is this, is that your words carry significant weight to your spouse. Your words carry significant weight to your kids. If you're a boss, your words carry significant weight to your employees. The source of the words ultimately determine the weight of those words. And so within our conversations, we must remember who we are, what we represent, and who we represent within our conversations to recognize that as the source of the words, our words within certain relationships carry much more weight. But this morning, we uncover dynamic number 3. And this dynamic within all lives and in all relationships is so easily forgotten. And when forgotten, can be absolutely catastrophic to our relationships. You see, the third dynamic of our words is this, is that intent is usually irrelevant. The intent of the words that we speak within our relationships is usually irrelevant in relation to the damage being done by our words. Your intent behind what you said is usually irrelevant to how you made them feel and ultimately the damage that you've done to your relationship, to their self-esteem, to their value and worth that they see in themselves. What you intended to say or what you meant rarely matters in the context of the damage that's been done. I'll still remember back. I was a junior or senior in high school, and on a Wednesday night after student men gathering, a bunch of us were out in the parking lot just hanging out. And there were several pockets of kids. There were some girls over here. There were some guys over here. And one of my younger friends had sort of been going back and forth with this girl, having fun with her, picking at her a little bit. And as she turned back around and retreated back to the girls' circle, he got this grand idea that he was going to charge up behind her as he was playfully sort of going back and forth with her. And he was going to jump on her back and get a piggyback ride from her by surprise. And so as we were standing there, this young man ran up behind this girl and he jumped onto her back. And by the way that her foot was planted in the ground and the sheer surprise of him coming up behind her and the weight of him in contrast to the weight of her, in that moment, it snapped her femur in two. And there she was, laying on the ground, writhing in pain. And yet this young man didn't mean to break her leg. It was an accident. And so because it was an accident, we looked at this girl lying on the ground and we said, it was just an accident. He didn't mean it. Suck it up. We didn't say that. You see, we called the squad immediately. We dialed 911 and the ambulance came, and because of the pain that she was in and the instability of her leg, I could still remember to this day the ambulance driving down 39 at about 20 miles an hour, not wanting to go over any bumps too hard because of the pain from her leg. And the reality was, in that moment, regardless of whether he intended to do it or not, it didn't lessen the damage that had been done. It being an accident didn't have any sort of determination on the outcome. See, the truth that we can see when it comes to physical stuff, but we often lose sight of when it comes to our words is this, is that there is absolutely no correlation between intent and outcome. There is no correlation when it comes to our words between intent and outcome. Your intent doesn't remove the dent. Your callous, hurtful, insensitive, or prideful words do damage. But Ben, I said with all due respect before I said it. Just because you said with all due respect doesn't mean you get to say whatever you want or you should say whatever you want. When something gets broken, it needs repairing. It's true no matter what facet of life we look at. When something gets broken, something needs to be done to fix it. And this concept is easy to understand with physical objects and yet so often overlooked when it comes to our words. Explaining does not equate to repairing. Explaining does not equate to repairing. When your kid is getting up from the dinner table and they're carrying their plate in one arm and their cup in the other, and they get distracted or they tried to carry too much or something that was on their plate begins to fall off and they go to catch it and they drop one of those things and it shatters in two on the ground, your kid explaining to you why they got distracted or why they dropped the cup or the plate doesn't put the plate back together. The explanation doesn't repair what has been broken. And when it comes to our words, oftentimes, the explanation has the opposite effect of what we intended. Y'all okay? Somehow in our minds, as the one who's dished out the hurtful words, we think the explanation is going to put things back together, when in reality, oftentimes the explanation creates a further fissure in our relationships, creates more distance between us and the other person. And you see, we know this to be true when we think of the moments where we've been on the receiving end of hurtful words. In those moments, what we know is I don't need an explanation. In those moments, what I need is I need to be glued back together again. I need this hurt to somehow be fixed in my life. But you just keep offering me an explanation. And then after your explanation, you just keep looking at me like, what's wrong with you? Because the explanation that I just gave is supposed to fix this. Why are you not all better after the explanation that I just gave? And y'all, we see, right, the flaw in that logic when we're the ones that have been hurt by the words. But we forget it when we're the ones who have delivered the hurtful words. why? Because when we're on the delivering end, we always revert back to intent. We always simply want to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, let ourselves off the hook. But what we miss in our attempt to explain our intent is that to the other person, our explanation feels like it's intended to shift blame. And y'all, this is going to hurt if you think of this through the lens of yourself. And I want to challenge you to do that, but to at least in the moment let you off the hook. I'm going to come at this from Ben Carver's mistakes, missteps, and perception when it comes to my words and the aftermath of saying something hurtful. You see, what I know about myself is this, is that when I stick my foot in my mouth, when I say something that was hurtful, what comes in the immediate aftermath of doing that is guilt, right? You've been there before. You have this immediate feeling, I wish I didn't say that. And ultimately, what you're feeling, whether you say it or not, is, I wish I didn't feel this way. I wish I wasn't carrying around this guilt. And what I want to do is offload this guilt as quickly as I possibly can. Eradicate this feeling that exists inside of me. And the best way that I know how to do that is to go back to you and to explain to you why I said what I said. And in explaining to you why I said what I said, here's what I'm hoping will happen. After you hear the intent behind it and the explanation, you will understand that you shouldn't have taken what I said the way you took it. Y'all okay? And now I've given you the explanation and the intent behind it, which isn't as bad as what you thought it was. Actually, it was really good intentions. I was just trying to help you out. With all due respect. And now I'm not the one to blame because now you realize you shouldn't have taken it the way you take it. And if you still have ill feelings, the blame is now on you. Uh-oh. You see, we want to offload the guilt as quickly as we can, and we think the magic wand to doing that and fixing things is an explanation in our lives. But to the person on the other side of the conversation who we've dished out the hurtful words, explaining just sounds like blaming. Explaining just sounds like blaming. That it really wasn't my fault that I said something hurtful, it was your fault because you took my hurtful words in the wrong way. But explaining doesn't just shift the blame, it also does something else. It creates pressure on the other person. And here's how. You see, ultimately, when we go into our explanation, the other person begins to feel this pressure from us that there needs to be resolution to this right now. That there needs to be a response to the explanation right now. That ultimately, my explanation is designed to make you go back to the way you were feeling a second before I said what I said. That my explanation is supposed to make you understand that our relationship should go back to the way it was a second before I said what I said. And the truth of the matter is that when we say something hurtful, we don't get that right. When we have dished out hurtful words, we don't get that right through a simple explanation to dictate whether things are fixed or not. But then we take it a step further. And we think, well, if an explanation isn't enough, then I've got the counterpunch. This sort of 1-2, that if I put these two things together, then that's going to fix everything. If I couple an explanation with an apology, then that'll make everything right. Then that'll put everything back in order. There's no way anyone can resist an explanation coupled with an apology to make them not feel the way that they were feeling. See, some of you know Krista and I's family dynamic. Within our house, we have two little boys, just turned 6 and 7 years old. And some of you can relate to this reality because you've had two boys or multiple boys in your house that have grown up in your house, and you've gone through the stage in which every single moment somehow turns into a wrestling match. That's how it is in our house. It doesn't matter what it is. Somewhere along the way, it's going to turn into a wrestling match, and it's going to turn into a fight. It could be over the remote. It could be outside and who gets into the playhouse first. Or there's two identical swings, but they both want the left swing. If the first one gets into the left one, the second one wants in there. And everything turns into a wrestling match. And as you can imagine, with a 6- and a 7-year-old little boy, they don't have complete control over what they're doing, both physically and mentally, all of the time. And so as you can imagine, when things constantly turn into a wrestling match, oftentimes there are unintended blows that happen to each other's heads. And in the aftermath of those unintended, sometimes unintended, blows to each other's head, there has become this belief that has risen up in both of my little boys. You see, for Krista and I, even when things are an accident, when the other person gets hurt, and ultimately when the blow to the head turns into tears, there is an apology that needs to take place. And yet over time, what the two of them have come to believe is this, is that in the immediate moment after the blow to the head has happened, if I say, sorry, bub, as quickly as possible, then that erases my fault in the matter. Things should go back to normal, and that excuses me, and I'm off the hook from any consequences whatsoever. And so they'll hit each other in the head, whether it was intended, not intended, accident or not, and immediately they'll say, sorry, bub. As if it's supposed to make everything go away. As if the tears are supposed to dry up and stop and the hurt's supposed to stop immediately because the apology was offered. And yet the truth of the matter is this. Is that apologies don't reverse and erase accidental injuries to the body. Right? Apologies don't reverse and erase accidental injuries to the body. But apologies also don't erase and reverse accidental injuries to the soul. You see, an apology combined with an explanation sounds an awful lot like an excuse. Because here's what's taking place. The moment we utter an apology, it's an admittance of wrong. I admit that I said something I shouldn't say. And following up that apology with an explanation automatically turns that explanation into an excuse. This is why you shouldn't have taken it the way you took it. This is why you shouldn't have been as hurt as you are. That's what it feels like on the other side. And you felt that when you've been the receiver of harsh words and someone comes to you expecting that the explanation is going to make everything all right. Our words carry weight. They do damage that oftentimes exceeds what a simple explanation can clean up. We must recognize that and understand that in order to move forward on the other side of hurtful words in the healthiest way possible, and before the hurtful words are dealt, to check ourselves and remind ourselves that even when we think we have the best of intentions, the way in which we speak to someone else still has the potential to do damage. James, the very brother of Jesus, begins to paint this picture for us of the power of our words and the power of our tongues. James, this guy who, dare I say, may be the greatest or one of the greatest proofs of the divinity of Jesus. Here was the brother of Jesus, and some of y'all have heard me say this before, who just believed that his brother was kooky dook. Because think of it from your perspective. How difficult would it be for your sibling to convince you that they were the son of God? Same for James. There ain't no way this dude is the son of God. I've been there when he wet the bed. I've been there when he did some of these things. There ain't no way he's the Son of God. Until he said he was going to die and come back to life, and then he went off and did it. And in an instant, everything changed for James. All of his doubt, all of his disbelief turned into James becoming the center of the local church in the city of Jerusalem.
And James, and looking back at his time with the Son of God, his brother, who was God, began to recollect on all of these things that Jesus talked about and all of these things that Jesus instilled into his followers. And one of the things that we find James honing in this third chapter of his letter is the power of our tongues and the damage that our tongues can do to the people around us. We pick it up in James chapter 3, starting in verse 2. Here is what he writes. Indeed, we all make mistakes. James couldn't have started with any more of a true statement than that. When it comes to our lives, and especially when it comes to our tongues and our words, we all make mistakes. We all find ourselves struggling with this. And then he continues, for if we could control our tongues, we would be perfect and could also control ourselves in every other way. You see, as James begins to paint this picture, here's essentially what James is saying. You know all those things in life that you struggle with, all the temptations that you find yourself so easily giving into? All of those things would be a whole lot easier to say no to if you were self-controlled enough to control your tongue first. It's as if James is saying mouth control is the ultimate self-control. Within our lives, our relationships, our daily occurrences, mouth control is the ultimate self-control. If you learn how to control your words, you will find it easier to control every other part of your life. And then he continues. In the same way, the tongue is a small thing that makes grand speeches. But a tiny spark can set a great forest on fire, right? We know this. We've lived this. We have the smoke or smog or whatever they call it that's floated over us from Canada, starting from a tiny spark, can set a great forest on fire. And among all the parts of the body, the tongue is a flame of fire. You see, what James is essentially saying is this. Our tongue is a fire that has the ability to burn down our relationships. Our tongue is a fire that can burn down our marriages. Our tongue is a fire that can burn down the relationships that we want with our grown kids. It's a fire that can burn down our employees, a fire that can burn down our message of Jesus that we have. And what do fires do? Fires spread. That from a tiny spark, a fire can spread and continue to do more and more damage. And as the fire is lit and the fire begins to spread amongst our relationships, we have two choices when the fire begins to burn on the other side of harsh words, on the other side of callous words. Option number one, we try to contain it. Option number two, we extinguish it. And oftentimes, if you're anything like me, I choose option number one, believing that I can contain it with an explanation. I can contain this fire and make it all right with an explanation. And that's like believing that we can put out a fire with our own hot air. By blowing on it that we're gonna put out a fire. And if you know anything about fire, you know that that never works, that just makes the fire grow and spread even quicker. But option number two is we can choose to extinguish it. And as Jesus' followers, here's how we extinguish the fire we've created with our words on the other side of it within our relationships where damage has been done. That we choose to extinguish the fire by in the aftermath and the things that are said and the interactions we have with that person by approaching it and using our words with excessive humility and sensitivity. That every word we speak in the aftermath of the hurtful words is done with great humility and great sensitivity. An explanation is all about me, making me feel better. Humility puts me in that person's shoes and recognizes the damage that's been done, the hurt that is there. The explanation elevates me. Humility elevates them. That is the choice that we have. That we can extinguish this and begin to experience healing within our relationships on the aftermath of hurtful words when we recognize the intent doesn't really matter. The damage has already been done. And now on the other side of the damage, I must approach this relationship with a ridiculous amount of humility. And here is an example of how it's done. That when we hurt somebody and we approach that person, lay down in bed beside that person at night, sit around the dinner table with that person, are standing next to them on the same line at our job with that person, and conversation is naturally going to happen, in the aftermath of those hurtful words, here's how we speak with humility. I'm so sorry. And what I do next is the most important part, y'all. Watch this. I'm so sorry. Period. And if you must say something else, rinse and repeat. I'm so sorry. You didn't deserve what I said. There is no excuse for that. I'm so sorry. That is what it looks like to approach the aftermath of my hurtful words with humility. No explanation to shift blame. No explanation to use as an excuse. Just an acknowledgement of my wrongdoing. And then this is so important. This is where I fail oftentimes. Once you've taken that space, or once you've taken that step, you then in turn give them space to allow them to control the restoration process. You see, if you're anything like me, I'm trying to do the right thing, I'm trying to fix this, I've offered my apology, and now I want to take the initiative for things to be restored. So whatever we got to do to make this right, let's do it, and let's do it right now. I'm willing to do anything. As the one who has dished out hurtful words, we no longer have the right to dictate the restoration pace or the restoration process. We have taken something from them. We don't get to take their control of the pace and the process of restoration. That is how we act, react with humility and sensitivity. We give them space to dictate how the restoration will go, when they are ready to heal, when they are ready to enter back into more serious conversations. And if you're a parent of a teenager or soon-to-be teenager, would you lean in for just a second? You see, what makes this so difficult as we raise our kids is this, is that when our kids are young, the restoration process can happen pretty quickly, right? We offer an apology, sometimes we even offer an explanation, and because of their immaturity and because of their deep desire to have your acceptance and your love, the process of restoration happens in an expedited fashion oftentimes when our kids are young. It just happens really, really quickly. And the danger is, oftentimes as our kids grow, we just expect that that same process will always take place with our kids. But as our kids grow and mature into young adults, whether you want to admit it or not, at 14, 15, 16 years old, the reality is as they mature, that restoration process will happen slower and slower. Because the damage that you've done with your words as your kids mature becomes greater and greater. And so if you want your relationship with your teenager to be restored in the aftermath of hurtful words that you've said to them, there comes a point in which you must shift to this exact same place of how you do this with adults. You do it the exact same with your teenager. That you offer them an apology. You didn't deserve what I said, how I said it, how I came at you. I'm so sorry. And then you give them space. And you love them in such a way that you allow them to dictate the pace of restoration. That's what's necessary when it comes to our relationship with our teenage kids. And y'all, I get it. All of this is difficult. Because none of this is intuitive and none of this comes natural. If you're anything like me, what does come natural? It's selfishness. That's what comes natural for me. I want myself to feel good. I want myself to look good. I want myself to not have to deal with guilt anymore. And yet, great relationships are built on our ability to eradicate selfishness. To get rid of selfishness and to replace it with humility and sensitivity within those relationships. That's how great marriages are built. You've heard me say this before. Marriage is a submission competition. It's a race to the back. That's how great marriages are built. That when I say something I shouldn't say, I offer an apology and I end it with a period. And then I allow my spouse and my love and my humility and my understanding that I have hurt them and taken something from them to dictate the pace of restoration. That's how great relationships are built. So as we finish this series, let me finish with a question. Is there somebody in your house who you've recently burnt with your words? Is there somebody that you're close to, in relationship with, that you've recently burnt with your words? And if so, there is an action step to take. But where we improve at this, at understanding the weight and the dynamics of our words, is we make the determination that I am going to ditch the explanation. Because I don't want to shift blame, because I don't want to place undue pressure on a person that I love. We stop taking control past an apology. We extinguish the fire that we started with our words by approaching what comes in the aftermath with great humility and great sensitivity. That's what love sounds like. That's what love does. This is how powerful our words are and what we must remember every single day. Don't use foul or abusive language. Let everything you say be good and helpful so that your words will be an encouragement to those who hear them. Our words aren't equally weighted. Source determines weight. And intent is usually irrelevant. And when we can remember those and begin to do those things better, that is when the weight of our words makes the people around us better and makes Jesus more known. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you that you are a God who has our best in mind, who wants what's best for us, who wants us to experience healthy relationship in our lives, who wants us to experience forgiveness and restoration within those relationships when we don't get it right. But God, in order for us to begin to move in the right direction with our words, we must understand the power of our words. like your brother here on earth wrote, our words are like a fire, a small spark that can catch an entire forest on fire. That's how powerful our words are. We must remember the small sparks that are coming from our mouth. I can set our marriages on fire, set our parenting relationships on fire, set our relationships with our coworkers on fire by forgetting that intent is usually irrelevant, but there is still damage being done. Even when we say, with all due respect, even when we think we have the best of intentions, but we allow our words to become callous. We allow our words to become prideful. And so God, with that, may we make the adjustments necessary to, number one, love people well. And number two, be a light for you in our dark world by the words that we say and what we do in the aftermath when we've got it wrong.